From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Today, March 5th, was supposed to be the deadline, the day President Trump set for the end of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. Congress was supposed to find a fix for the so-called Dreamers, and yet, here we are. A recent Supreme Court decision gave the program temporary relief for now, meaning Congress has no DACA deadline, and all of a sudden, the urgency for lawmakers is gone, if not for the hundreds of thousands of DACA recipients still in limbo. This hour on point with a hurry up and wait on DACA, is any immigration deal possible? And if so, when? You can join us on air and online. Do you think Congress will make a deal for the Dreamers? And how long will it take? What shape should it take? Are you a dreamer? Let us know what you're thinking about immigration today. You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Washington today is Fernando Pizarro. He's a Univision Washington correspondent covering Congress, the White House, and immigration. Fernando, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
So here's the image I have in my head. We had a balloon. It was full of air and energy around immigration, and all of a sudden, all we're left is with a deflated balloon. Is that kind of the feeling around DACA and immigration on the Hill right now?
It's funny because you're using words that some members of Congress have used, that the balloon is left with no air. Unfortunately, this is not funny, but you know, basically the urgency has disappeared when it comes to Congress. There's almost no action right now. There are some proposals. We can talk about them later, but basically what this has left is DACA in an extremely precarious situation. There's a lot of confusion among dreamers, among activists, among lawmakers about what's going on right now. And basically, from the congressional side, there's nothing going on.
Okay, so but help us understand what the signals that we are getting mean. I mean, for example, to your point, John Cornyn is saying, you know, we don't do things around here being Congress unless there's, quote, a deadline. Senator Lindsey Graham recently was quoted as being very exasperated when he was asked about if there's going to be a deal. And he said, quote, I have no idea. But on the other hand, I'm seeing Senator David Perdue of Georgia saying, quote, we still have the motivation. There's uncertainty if it's this year or next year. But there are conversations that he's involved in that he says are ongoing. And, you know, we got very close last time. So what does that mean? I mean, does that mean that there's still desire, but that desire is years off waiting for, or maybe waiting for November 2018?
Yes, we got close in a few weeks ago. As we all know, there were four Senate bills that were brought to the floor. They all failed to get the 60 votes necessary to go on. The version that was most favored by the Trump administration, which was the Cotton, Perdue, among others, Senators Lankford, Tillis, Cornyn, were pushing for this, for the toughest bill, and the administration gave it all its support. That was the one that got the least votes of all. But yes, there are some proposals right now on the table. Jeff Flake, Republican from Arizona, is heading a bipartisan effort to force a vote, maybe this week, highly unlikely, but to extend DACA for 3 years and supply 3 years in exchange of border security money.
But doesn't that seem like a long shot too, though?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And we're facing another funding measure by and deadline by March 23rd. Yes, we avoided with the big agreement reached last month. We avoided another shutdown, but we are looking at a March 23rd deadline anyway, in which Congress has to act. There is another bill on the House side, very conservative bill headed by Congressman Virginia Republican Bob Goodlatte, who's been very active in immigration all these years, and he's been head of the Judiciary Committee at times, Immigration Subcommittee as well. And he's heading a very, what we would call, harder line bill that wants to address DACA, but wouldn't be as generous as some of the bills that we've seen on the Senate side. And it's a big question mark whether it would get the votes necessary to pass the House, even though that's where we see the most conservative group of members that would a line behind such a bill, but it's still very much in limbo.
So can I just jump in here, Fernando, for a second?
Go ahead,
because
of course.
Help me understand this, because it seems as if there's a fundamental self-contradictory impulse in Washington, in Congress right now, because, you know, at least ostensibly we have bipartisan agreement that some action for DACA recipients should be taken, right? And in an ideal world, maybe a so-called clean DACA bill might actually work out. But the point is that it's still embedded in the larger discussion and intense debate over immigration. So we will never get a clean DACA bill. And so therefore, it seems as if virtually any proposal, given the hard stances that both conservatives and liberals in Congress are taking on immigration, virtually any proposal is dead in the water.
With this administration and this Congress, I think a clean DACA bill, as we call a Dream Act without any other conditions, I think has been off the table for a while. Activists have been pushing it very hard all of 2017, of course, even more after September 5th when the Trump administration announced the end of the program and gave Dreamers whose DACA would expire before March 5th, which is today, had to renew. And then after March 5th, that was the time in which Congress in between had these 6 months to negotiate. But I think the Clean Dream Act is not in the cards right now. There's going to be some kind of compromise, if there is any, at this moment, because the situation right now, if I may explain what's going on right now in the courts, as you know, some states, attorneys general from California, Maine, Maryland, Minnesota, plus the University of California and other cities, they sued. And on January 9th, the California Circuit Court basically place an injunction blocking the end of DACA while the litigation continues. And later, another district court in New York issued a similar ruling. So last week, the Supreme Court denied the Trump administration request to review this case in an expedited way, which is an unusual request anyway, because it's skipping the appeals court. Mm-hmm. So now the case goes to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that needs to look at this case. But the decision, they could not maybe make it for months, maybe June at the earliest. And so now in practical terms, this deadline of March 5th, it's quite meaningless from a practical, procedural perspective, maybe, or administratively, because Dreamers now can't reapply or continue applying. Even kids whose DACA was expiring as of tomorrow, which they were not going to have any chance to do that, now they can do that because DHS has confirmed that they will continue to receive renewal applications as long as the courts haven't decided. But what if the Court of Appeals makes a decision at some point? So that is why this is such in a limbo state, because there is a lot of uncertainty.
Right.
Only 11,000, these are USCIS figures given last week by the agency, only 11,000 Dreamers have submitted renewal applications after the January 9th decision. But
Fernando,
I'm
going to jump in here because what you're saying is a perfect transition to another voice I want to bring in to the conversation. Karina Iribe Romo, she's joining us today from Tempe, Arizona. She's a 28-year-old with DACA status. She came to the United States from Mexico when she was 7 years old, and she's advocacy director of a student organization called Undocumented Students for Education Equity. Karina, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna. Thank you for having me.
So you heard Fernando say that there may be no DACA deadline today, but there's still limbo and uncertainty. Is that how you feel?
Yeah, I certainly feel that way. I think these last few months, like he was outlining, all of the different events have definitely been a roller coaster. For myself, and I can imagine for, you know, close to a million youth across the country, how it has felt. I luckily was able to renew my DACA before the first deadline that was issued when the program was initially rescinded. But I can only imagine what it felt like if you weren't able to renew all of those months, not knowing if Congress was going to act fortunately, we have the decision from the court now. So yes, it's definitely been a crazy ride these last few months.
Yeah, I mean, as Fernando said, I mean, it's a decision that remands the case back down to the Ninth Circuit, but it's only, you know, it could only provide a couple of months of uncertainty, and then we don't know what's going to happen next. But you have written an article called "We Need a Permanent Solution for the Dreamers." We've got a link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. But I mean, Karina, describe to me in your view, what would a permanent solution look like?
I think there's a lot of discussion about what a solution looks like, bipartisanship, negotiations, agreements.
What would be your view? What is your vision?
My vision is a protection that recognizes the humanity of these people like myself and the contributions we've given to this country and recognizes the time that we've been here. So a legislation that provides a pathway to citizenship, a solution that is as inclusive as possible for our youth when we're talking about age limits, mm-hmm. and a solution that doesn't come with additional enforcement policies that are going to criminalize people in our community and other communities as well. And not limit legal migration, which is an attempt that's being made currently by the administration, is using this as a door to limit legal migration.
We got a couple seconds here before we have to go to a break here. So you just heard Karina Uribe Romo. She's joining us from Tempe, Arizona. She's a DACA recipient, talking about her view on what DACA legislation might look like. We're also joined today by Fernando Pizarro, Univision correspondent in Washington. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by the new CNN original series, Pope, the Most Powerful Man in History, a dramatic new 6-part series narrated by Liam Neeson that links recent news events surrounding the Vatican to their unexpected historical origins in the Catholic Church. From the start of the papacy to struggles with corruption to the challenges faced by wartime popes, go inside the Vatican to explore the roles of popes throughout history and how they spread Catholicism around the world. Pope airs Sundays at 10 p.m. Eastern on CNN.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A, a show where people gather to speak freely. You might learn something new, hear things that challenge you, and on Friday, we review the week's top stories. You'll find the 1A podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about DACA and whether Congress can make any headway on immigration now, and you can join the conversation. Over in California, the mayor of Oakland alerted some folks out there to a potential ICE raid. What do you make of that? And do you expect to see perhaps a border wall to go up soon as part of an immigration deal? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're joined today by Fernando Pizarro, Univision correspondent covering Congress, the White House, and immigration. We also have with us Karina Uribe Romo. She's a 28-year-old activist with DACA status. Karina, I have a quick question from you. Back in January, CBS News put out a poll where they found that 86% of Americans support keeping DACA in place. Okay, so they wanted some sort of deportation protection for young dreamers. But in that same poll, 2/3 of respondents also said they support enacting DACA legislation with more funding for a border wall. Is that the kind of compromise that you could accept?
I think, as you know, I've been doing community organizing for the last 5 years, and I've seen what enforcement, specifically here in Arizona, with SB 1070 or PIO being a border state, has done to the community. I've seen a mother be ripped away from her children after living here for decades. So to me, as community organizer, it's about holding the line and demanding, again, legislation that recognizes the humanity and contributions of immigrants. And to me, that doesn't mean talking about compromise or negotiations. It means demanding the most possible protection for people.
Mm. Now, in your case, you have a son, right?
Correct.
Yeah, he's a U.S. citizen.
Yes.
So talk to me about that. I mean, what impact is the uncertainty around your status having on your family?
Yeah, I've said before that I would not go back into the shadows. I think that's really not an option for me, even if I were to lose my protected status. However, that doesn't mean that in practicality, it's going to be easy. It's certainly very unsettling to think about how would I provide for my son? How would I, you know, care for him? What would happen if I were to be deported? It's a lot to think about. So there is definitely a lot of uncertainty when it comes to my individual situation. And it has also been a roller coaster these past few months for me with everything happening with DACA and Congress and the inaction and no permanent solution. So it's still something that I think about. It influences every decision I make. Am I going to go back to school for, you know, a concurrent degree? Am I going to seek another job? Are we going to have to sell our home? You know, all of these things. Do I need to set up a caregiver in case, you know, something happens to me?
Well, Corina Uribe-Romo joining us today from Tempe, Arizona. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your story with us. It's much appreciated.
Thank you.
Fernando, react to what you heard Corina say. I mean, obviously, we're talking directly in terms of legislation that might have an impact on hundreds of thousands of DACA recipients. But there's a broader circle of family members around virtually all of them.
Right. Obviously, this puts in limbo the situation of many families. Let's remember that the Obama administration, when they implemented DACA, which was June 15th, 2012, you know, it was contested in court right away. But then they tried later to expand DACA, to make it for a bigger cohort of Dreamers in terms of age. And they also tried to expand that to their parents, which was a program that was supposed to be called DAPA. And the expanded DACA and DAPA was, we could call, defeated in the Supreme Court. The case went all the way up there when Texas sued to block that and other states, 25 other states. And basically, it was stuck in the Supreme Court at the time. Neil Gorsuch was not part of the Supreme Court, so we had a 4-4 decision. So we kept the injunction. The program has been terminated. So this just touches so many people, this uncertainty of the Dreamers. And now think about, if I want to give you a little perspective, fundamentally, things haven't really changed in immigration for the last 17, 18 years. Mm-hmm. Basically, President George W. Bush was trying to do something on immigration before 9/11 hit. That pushed things back. Then came the Iraq War. Then his administration did a big push back in 2006, which ended with the failure of a comprehensive immigration reform bill in 2007, which included changes to the family migration, though. Let me point that out. But it also was talking about legalizing 11 million people.
Right. I mean, a lot of people would say that Democrats overreached at that moment, that that was a point.
But that was a Republican pushed bill. It was pushed by the Bush administration. Let's remember, it all started with the McCain-Kennedy bill, which morphed into something else. But that's what was defeated in 2007. Then the DREAM Act was voted on by itself in 2010, and it was defeated in the Senate, and it did pass the House. And then came the 2013 Comprehensive Immigration Reform Bill, which also dealt with legalizing 11 million people, and it talked about border security. I don't remember the figure exactly. Maybe it was $20-40 billion for border security. Not necessarily a wall, but it was border security, technology, personnel, and that was never voted on the House. So things haven't really changed.
Well, so we've got a lot of folks who want to join this conversation. Let's start hearing from them. Al is calling from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Al, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm not a supporter of DACA. I support the law as it stands. Unfortunately, these kids got swindled by their parents and by Obama. Obama's executive order, not a law, gave them a false promise. Now they're going to be losers. Anything which is amnesty is simply not going to be acceptable. you know, I take one small concession. I would deport them and give them the opportunity of reentering on a shorter line. That's as much of a compromise as I'm interested in.
Al, how practicable is that, though? I mean, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who have lived the majority of their lives in the United States.
You know, unfortunately, this is a difficult situation. As I say, they were swindled by their parents. Their parents made a bad gamble. And it's not going to be able to be resolved. Anything which is close to amnesty will result in an explosion of problems for no Republican who votes for this will survive.
Right. Al, thank you so much for your call. Much appreciated. Fernando, to Al's last point there, I think you hit on something quite important, that any indication of unacceptable compromise and unacceptable from the point of view of Republican voters is one of the things that's really standing in the way of reaching compromise. And this is something that Republican members, especially in the House, have to pay close attention to. Again, I mean, I'm thinking the midterms are showing us that perhaps distrust is as high as ever with this issue.
Well, this shows the polarization that exists on this issue and has existed for a while, and it tends to go down partisan lines. The Democrats tend to favor, something done legalizing undocumented immigrants, and Republicans do not. That it's not necessarily a black and white issue. There are many Republicans who have wanted to do something. There is a group of Republicans, both in the Senate and in the House, who do not, that are the color would agree with them that, you know, anything that is some kind of legalization, whether it's limited or broad, is some sort of an amnesty, and they're not willing to accept it, and they could be, you know, punished in November. We'll see what happens. Yeah. I mean, this is obviously such a difficult issue, and it is difficult for Republicans to deal with, because once you seem moderate on this issue, you can be basically punished by your voters who will not agree with you.
Yeah, so I was seeing Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post recently wrote that Dreamers who've spent virtually their entire lives in the United States will be on TV nonstop. She's thinking in advance of the midterms, describing their loyalty to this country. It's another political nightmare for Republicans, specifically Nevada, Florida, California, and Arizona, she writes, where a mobilized Hispanic vote could deliver knockout punches to Republican candidates.
Well, I think, yes, we will see the Dreamers today. This deadline day was marked by marches by one of the biggest organizations and oldest Dream organizations, United We Dream, marched to the Capitol today. And this happened in many cities around the country. But yes, we will continue to see this issue, and it will be an election issue. Will it be the most important issue, which again and again, immigration tends to get a lot of press, but then when you look at voters, sometimes immigration is not and has not consistently been for the last 15, 20 years the top issue for voters in a general election.
Fernando, let me ask you, though. I mean, I suppose we should hit this next question head on. I mean, how much of this does rest on President Trump? Because first of all, I mean, he wanted to end DACA. He made this deadline of March 5th. That deadline is moot now. But, Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell have both said that they'll only consider bills that have the president's support that he would sign. And meanwhile, we have the president who's blaming Democrats. He's been recently saying, I'm the one pushing DACA. Democrats are nowhere to be found. But on the other hand, I mean, we have pro-immigration folks who are saying things. This is from Todd Schulte, who says, quote, Trump said he'd sign a Dreamer and border wall deal. It said he'd sign what Congress passed, even said he'd take the heat if his own base was upset. But since then, he's rejected five different bipartisan deals. So I guess my question, Fernando, is how much of a difference would it make if the president came out and said specifically and without wavering that this, you know, X is what I would accept and will sign?
Well, he has already said that the problem is that then the administration takes a different line. He said that publicly in that famously televised, basically hour-long meeting with Republican and Democratic senators on this issue alone. And he said that just bring me a deal and I will sign it. And then a couple of days later, the administration changed their tune, and the And DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, put out very, very strong statements against some of the bills that were bipartisan. And they were pushing the bill that, as I mentioned before, got the fewest votes in the Senate votes on a couple of weeks ago on the Senate floor, which was the harshest bill on this issue and the less generous one. Yeah, he has the power to say, okay, I'm going to accept this deal. But until the administration really comes through with that, it's very hard to tell. Obviously, this issue is so politicized. The Congressional Hispanic Caucus last week, the group of basically Latino Democrats in the House of Representatives, including Senator Menendez, obviously, too, they blamed President Trump for the failure in the Senate because basically they feel that the administration continuously moved the goalposts.
They
came out with their priorities very clearly last year, like in November. They said, we want these four topics. And then he insisted again on them in the State of the Union. Mm-hmm. But they feel that they moved the goalposts in the negotiation.
I want to welcome in another voice into this conversation. Stephen Lee joins us. He's a professor of law at the University of California Irvine School of Law, and he teaches administrative law and immigration law there. Stephen Lee, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
So, glad to have you. What's your take about this moment that we find ourselves in regarding immigration reform or an immigration deal? Does it seem as intractable as ever to you as it, quite frankly, it does to me?
Well, unfortunately, the modern era has been defined by legislative gridlock. So this is why we saw action taking place in the executive branch under President Obama's tenure. I mean, in other words, he had been imploring Congress to take action for years, and after a series of inactions described on the show already, President Obama was forced to take action through channels available to him as President of the United States. And not surprisingly, we're also seeing the courts weighing in today in response to the number of actions that President Trump has taken as well. Again, and importantly, the actor that's not taking any action is the members of Congress.
Right. So tell me more about the role of the courts here.
Well, historically, the courts have weighed in as a sort of stabilizing force, trying to ensure that the passions of the moment don't carry the law too far in one direction or the other. And I think that's one of the things we've seen repeatedly as President Trump has tried to pursue extreme policies, both in the form of DACA rescission, also in its engagement with local localities in terms of the sanctuary cities and also with regards to the travel ban.
Yeah. Well, I want to hear a lot more from folks who want to have their say. So let's just quickly take a call here. Amy's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Amy.
Hi, Meghna. My questions at this point, you've changed topic a little bit. So I'll start with my original question was that I really feel that as left-wing maybe this isn't just left-wing radio, but why are we talking about making a compromise? Because all that does is legitimize the argument that these people are criminals and that they're kids. They're kids who got brought here. They were kids. Their parents were in desperate situations. And we're not, the minute we start talking about the compromise or a wall compromise, we stop talking about the humanity of these people. These were children who were brought here in desperate situations.
I take your point, Amy, but if not a compromise, then what?
Well, a compromise, then I guess this is my big question is that I obviously feel I'm obviously a lefty. I come from a lefty state, but what I don't understand is if people really understood, here's my question, really understood what this was doing, how it was going to really rip families apart, how it was really going to destroy people's lives, if that was put on the other side, on their media, would they really, really be asking for this kind of compromise? I feel like, I guess that's my question. How do we get it? Because I don't think everybody really is that evil. Like, cause it's so inhumane the way we're talking about these DACA recipients.
Amy, let me just jump in here because you're asking a good question and I appreciate it. Stephen Lee, we just got a minute or so before we have to take a break here. But what's your reaction, your response to Amy's question?
I really like that observation in part because it forces us to look beyond the current session that Congress is in. I think one of the challenges that advocates face and educators face is letting the public know exactly how deep this problem runs. So the gentleman earlier who talked about no amnesty and focusing on the kind of bad act of a parent either crossing the border surreptitiously or overstaying the visa suggested that act is the only thing that matters. I think it matters that, for example, in the 90s, well, I could talk more about it later, but U.S. foreign policy has directly contributed to displacing people so that the only viable option is to come to the United States. Mm. So are people acting badly in crossing the border? I mean, arguably. But is the U.S. Also partially responsible? Yes, we also have dirty hands. Right. U.S. consumers also have dirty hands in benefiting from consumers' products that are generated by exploitable labor both abroad and here.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the sudden lack of urgency on immigration reform in Congress and the broader state of immigration in the United States. We're joined today by Fernando Pizarro and Stephen Lee. And joining us now from Chicago is U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois. He's been minority whip since 2015 and a longtime sponsor of the DREAM Act. Senator Durbin, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
Do you have any hope at all that any motion can be made on DACA or immigration reform before the midterm elections?
I can't say that anything will occur unless President Trump supports it. He was given six different bipartisan solutions to the problem that he created on September the 5th. He's rejected all of them, including a proposal in the Senate which gave him his god-awful wall. So I don't know what it will take to bring this president around. He created this crisis. He's the only one now politically who can solve it.
Well, but on the other hand, I mean, members of Congress can continue to push for any one of these solutions, though. I mean, the point is that he hasn't actually had a bill put in front of him to sign or veto.
The reality is the Republicans control the House and the Senate. Without the president's support, many Republicans are afraid to vote for anything related to DACA or Dreamers, even though they tell me privately they'd like to see the solution come forward. But when we tried to bring the measures to the floor and pass them 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. We were unable to muster 60 votes. I might say the president offered his immigration proposal, and in the 100-member Senate, it only had 39 who supported it. So it's a pretty dismal showing for his approach.
Well, a little earlier in the hour, I read a quotation from Senator David Perdue of Georgia, who he said that there's still motivation. The only uncertainty is when, this year or next year. I mean, is that as good as it's going to get now? And perhaps it's not so bad.
Senator Perdue is, along with Senator Cotton, are both pushing a proposal which would dramatically cut legal immigration to America. It would be the deepest cut in legal immigration since the 1930s, when we passed 1920s. I'm sorry, when we passed that embarrassing, awful immigration policy of quotas. So his approach to this is not going to solve it. It was the approach that was included in the president's measure that won 39 votes in the Senate 2 weeks ago.
Hmm. So, Senator Durbin, I mean, give us then a sense as to, it just seems as if it's going to be more of the same now, and that the window of hope that we had, in part because of the president's deadline, that's closed. And are we going to be in another, as Fernando was telling us earlier, another 15-year cycle of lack of immigration reform?
Well, I hope not. And, of course, the decision or the answer to that question is in the hands of the voters. If they are fed up with what this president has done to these young, innocent people who were brought here as children to the United States and are simply asking for a chance to earn their way to legalization and citizenship, if the American people are fed up with what the president did on September 5th and we see it in the polls in November, then perhaps we can turn this around. But the president created this humanitarian crisis. He is the only one now who can solve it.
Well, that's Senator Dick Durbin, Democratic senator from Illinois, minority whip since 2015 and longtime sponsor of the DREAM Act. Senator Durbin, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Fernando, you've been following this as long as anyone. What do you make of what the senator just said?
Well, basically, you know, it shows what what we had talked about before, as long as the president doesn't agree with the White House does not agree with some of these proposals coming out of the out of Congress, there's going to be very little done. What's interesting here is why this administration has also changed the playing field in a way is because they are one of the things that really has a lot of opposition, as Senator Durbin said, is the family migration change or proposal to change family migration. That was part of the 2007 bill, one of the reasons why it failed in the Senate as well. But now this administration has really taken a broader front against immigration, legal and illegal. They are now eliminating programs such as TPS, the temporary protected status for Salvadorians, and the one for Honduras is in limbo, still for pending for review for Nicaraguans, for Haiti, for a lot of countries. They are trying to change family migration in the deepest way it's been in decades. And they're trying to reform visas. You know, there are a lot of fronts that they're trying to tackle that were not in discussion before. Mm-hmm. So I think they've made a deal, as they like to call it in the White, as the president likes to talk about deals, they made the deal harder because there are more things to agree about.
Right.
And also the Democrats have lost a lot of their leverage. Obviously, they're not in control of Congress. And now, look what we were discussing 3-4 years ago, legalizing 11 million people. Now we're looking at only the Dreamers and in exchange for a wall. That shows you the level of power that the Democrats are wielding right now.
I mean, you heard it in Senator Durbin's voice, essentially. I mean, he was shrugging and saying, well, we can't do anything. So
they can't do anything else.
Yeah.
You know, they have very little power compared to before.
Stephen Lee, I mean, first of all, I want to say I know there's a ton of callers who want to get on. I'm going to try and get to you in a moment. But I want to also just broaden this conversation a little bit because, you know, regarding immigration writ law, we have had, you were mentioning this before, some significant action in the courts, right? Just recently, for example, there was a major Supreme Court ruling that essentially is found that that criminally charged or criminally convicted immigrants held in the United States awaiting action on their immigration status no longer have the right to a bond hearing or a regular bond hearing. So, I mean, that was a major ruling that recently happened in the Supreme Court. What's your thoughts on that issue as well?
So, of course, you're referring to the Jennings versus Rodriguez decision.
Yes.
And typically when an immigrant is put in removal proceedings, she has a chance to show that she's eligible for bond so long as she's not a flight risk or a danger to the community. Congress has decided as a matter of policy that certain categories of non-citizens shall be mandatorily detained. So this is the mandatory detention provision. And it's actually a very broad cross-section of immigrants, not just people who've been convicted of certain crimes, also those who are seeking asylum at the border, mm-hmm. as well as those who have been engaging in some sort of misrepresentation at the border as well.
Yeah, the majority essentially found in its opinion, written by Justice Alito, that there's nothing in federal immigration statutes that would require a bond hearing.
That's right. And it's important to note that the court's decision was grounded in an interpretation of the statute. It said that the statutes here cannot be interpreted in a way that would justify a bond hearing in every 6-month intervals. So as a result, it relegated the decision back down to the Ninth Circuit to address for the first time the constitutionality of such a situation. So I think the case will continue and eventually make its way back up to the Supreme Court issue.
It's interesting because the Supreme Court has also said that that they felt that there were other tools available to legal advocates for these people, such as submitting writs of habeas corpus. So it wasn't in the eyes of the majority, it's not as if these folks are now lost to a black hole of the legal system.
That's right, but I also think it overstates the utility of those tools, in part because the detention system is huge and sprawling. In any given day, I think there are more than 330,000 immigrants who are detained. So the idea that this sort of release would operate on a case-by-case basis by the vehicle of habeas seems a little preposterous from the perspective of trying to identify people who actually are eligible for bond.
Well, Stephen Breyer wrote the dissent, right? And he said, reading his opinion from the bench, said that this is the first time since the Civil War that the United States would have effectively created a class of people who are beyond the reach of the Constitution.
That's right. And what's interesting about all this is that with all things, as with so many things with this court, a lot of this ties into what Kennedy decided to do. If you go back to a decision in 2003, DeMoore versus Kim, the Supreme Court held that immigrants pending removal proceedings could be subject to mandatory detention. And it's important to note that the court grounded its holding in the idea that immigrants are detained only for a short period of time. Two things are notable. Number one, Justice Kennedy wrote separately to note that if there was some sort of evidence of incompetence or arbitrariness, then he would take a more scrutinizing view. And I think that's what's going to be at play in this next round of briefing. The second point is that the court relied on the government's representation that the proceedings or the detention period was very short. Of course, later the federal government had to disclose that that was an erroneous representation. Actually, people were being detained for much longer periods of time, and that's particularly what was troubling to Justice Breyer. Yeah. He said, in this case, we have people who are, on average, being detained a year.
Yeah. Well,
a year without the opportunity to present their case.
It was a major case, and there's so much going on in immigration in the United States. I wanted to touch on it. Professor Lee, I appreciate you walking us through that. But let's now go back to our callers, because there's a ton of you who want to get in here, and I appreciate your patience. So, Ben, go to you first, calling from Boston, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Ben.
Hi, Magna. This is a little bit frustrating because this is really very simple. I'm an ardent Trump supporter, and as far as these kids were brought here as children, I'm happy to make them citizens. I don't want to give them a pathway to citizenship. I just assume make them citizens. However, I need to be assured that the border is sealed off so the problem is not getting worse. And that's with President Trump, that's all he's asking for, is just to be able to say to his base, folks, I know that a lot of you don't want to do this. However, it's the right thing to do. And I can assure you that this is the last time that we'll have to do this. And if that's what people really want to do, it is imminently doable.
Ben, thank you so much for your call. Fernando? Did Ben's version of a compromise seem workable in Washington?
Well, it seemed very simple, and in a way, just like he said, it's simple. But the problem is that that compromise that he's talking about is what was proposed at some moment, and that what the Democrats have given in to say, okay, we'll give you the money for the wall. But that's not what, in the end, the Trump administration was willing to support. They say we want our four conditions, as they call them, their four pillars, or nothing. And the pillars are the wall, ending the visa lottery, which is it's somewhat limited system of 50,000 visas, immigrant visas given every year. And then the big gorilla in the room, which is the family migration changes, which creates so much opposition among many members of Congress in both parties.
I want to see if I can sneak in a couple more calls here before we run out of time. Glenn is calling from Asheville, North Carolina. You're on the air, Glenn.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Doing away with all the ideology portion of this, I'd like to just throw a little bit of reality into the situation. These folks who have been here for a long time are deeply integrated into our culture. They're deeply integrated into our economy as labor force, as intellectuals, as producers, as consumers. And getting rid of these folks would play just absolute havoc to our economy. I don't think it's a realistic thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Glenn, thank you so much for your call. Let's get a response on that from Jorge, who's calling from Charlottesville, Virginia. You're on the air, Jorge.
Hi, I just have a comment about the whole situation. I personally am not in support of DACA Dreamers to be deported. However, I have to say that the way they portray it, it's always like it's so bad to go back to their home country. So I don't think that's the issue. I mean, most of their countries, home countries, are not in war anymore. And they knew for the last 20 years that this day might come, so they could have prepared for that. You know, if I was going to be deported with my and separated from my children, I would take my children back to my home country, and where, you know, there's a lot of benefits in Mexico, Honduras, Nicaragua nowadays. University is free. Children can grow also just as good as they can grow here. So it's not that of a, you know, the end of the world to be returned to your home country. It's not that.
Well, they would. But so Jorge, let me just jump in here, and I appreciate your thoughts. But I'm just wondering what you think when it seems as if a lot of DACA recipients would say the United States is their home country. In spirit, yes. If not in law.
Yes, exactly. I understand that. But if they were going to be deported, I mean, they're being reported to a place where they had relatives. And if they had been in this country for 20 years, I'm sure they could have built some equity. And, you know, if they return home to Mexico or other country, they could buy easily a home over there, much cheaper than it is in the States. Everything is much cheaper down there.
Jorge, I'm going to jump in here because I want to give our guests the time to respond. Thank you so much for your call, and Glenn, to you before that. Stephen Lee, we've just got a couple of minutes to go here. I mean, you've been listening in through this whole hour. I think it's a pretty good representation of the complexity of the ongoing immigration conversation in this country, which, you know, makes me wonder, from your perspective as a legal analyst, a legal expert, what is the best way forward?
Well, I first of all, I support any kind of Dream Act that's clean, that does not include you know, the kind of wall that President Trump advocates. And I think that's probably an ideal solution. But even beyond that, if you look at smaller solutions, I think part of what's troubling is that many of these people, as a gentleman from Asheville pointed out, are deeply integrated into our communities. And a problem that many immigrants face is that precisely at the moment where they find perhaps a relationship, a marriage to a U.S. citizen, they're denied the opportunity to regularize their status. Mm. People who cross the border are subject to what's known as the 3 and 10 bar if they have to leave the United States, and they can't then come back to the United States for a number of years. So precisely at the moment at which they're ready to sort of, you know, integrate, engage in marital bonds, they're forced to leave, and they're forced to stay out of the United States for a decade.
Right.
So I think just that little fix right there could do a lot of good for at least those immigrants who are deeply integrated into our communities.
Fernando Pizarro, we've got 30 seconds here. Last thought goes to you today.
I think my prediction is that this probably won't get solved for the next few months. We may get all the way to November. And, of course, the Circuit Court of Appeals could have a word on this and maybe change the course of DACA depending on their decision.
Well, that's Fernando Pizarro, Univision Washington correspondent. Thank you so much for your insight and your expertise, Fernando. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Stephen Lee, professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law. Professor Lee, many thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Benda.
And remember, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.